K2RIW here, K2 Romeo, India, Whiskey. And as you guys know from past years, we hold a TechNet on Sunday night starting at 8 p.m. And if we have enough enthusiasm, don't fall asleep, we should last until midnight. Broken up into three sections, it's a gathering of curious radio amateurs who want to know more about wireless equipment, ham radio equipment in particular. Oh, I'm glad to see that Selden is connected earlier tonight. It wasn't. And also, we had a very brief tail on the end. Let me see if that's also happening. Yeah, we have a very brief tail. So it looks like the machine is operating under slightly different conditions. The TechNet is broken up, technical net is broken up into three sections. The first section is where people sign in because they do have a question or a comment. We take those in order and try to answer their questions. Do remember, there's no such thing as a dumb question. Lots of people are afraid to sign in because they think the question is too simple. The so-called dumb question represents the biggest difference between what the guy knows and what he would like to know, so it's really the most deserving question for an answer. The second section is run by Roy, AC2GS, and Dr. Roy, a practicing physician, gives us the science talk and the mailbag. And the third section is run by Paul, WS2N, you heard him briefly. He gives us the space report, and there was an interesting launch and abort system check that took place this week that Paul will be telling us about. And if we have very few people signing in, I'm going to give you guys a puzzle, and I'm pretty sure that Roy will be giving you a puzzle also. All right, we already have a check-in from Joe to B2RYY. Anyone else to check in, because you do have a question or a comment for the TechNet, Technical Net, give me a call, letters and name.
Mark, Ed, K2GJE, yes.
WB2GXM, Rich, and yes.
Okay.
WS2N, Dick West, I heard from Roy, he's not going to make it.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I guess his laryngitis is still up. Okay, we did get K2GJE, Ed, WB2GXM, Rich. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now. One last call. Anyone else to check in? Because you do have a question or a comment for the Technical Net, please give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, I heard Romeo Sierra Lee. What is the prefix to that one, Lee? Altogether, it's what, about an hour's worth of a show? Go ahead.
About 46 minutes, I think. It starts before they had the stop and the countdown at like 31 seconds. And it's called full cockpit view plus cockpit audio and then STS-135. And I have not looked at it, you know, further down. It's one I recognize. It's from July 2011, which I gave you the DVD for that come off of a NASA channel way back when. So knock yourselves out with that one. So you put that type of search in with those words, I'm sure you'll come up with it. I come up with these things occasionally, just like I come up with the one that said riding the boosters. I'm not looking for them, I just find them. Anyway, the question for tonight for you to think about is this. The eating system question. I had an old boiler, which I don't have anymore because I'm getting it replaced, but this boiler had a rating of 151,000 BTUs at 1.25 GPH, or gallons per hour, which people don't understand what that means, for a rating. Now, that was also at probably 100 pounds of oil pressure. If you used a 0.65 GPH tip, but 150 PSI, which brings it up to, I think, the chart says like 80.81 gallons per hour, what does that do to the BTU rating of the burner? Back to you.
Assuming that the nozzle, particularly when it's being fed 150 pounds per square inch, as opposed to the old number they used, 100, gives you very fine atomization. The very fine atomization, in other words, the oil is broken up into very fine droplets, and when you've got the correct oil-air mixture, it's a direct proportion. In other words, the gallons per hour of the oil properly oxygenated and burned will give you a number of BTUs of the flame, which is directly proportional to the number of gallons. So if you halved the number of gallons per hour of fuel, then the total heat output of the flame, properly atomized and properly air mixed, should be exactly half the number of BTUs. So the BTU is strictly a function of how much oil you're burning, because the atomized oil mixed with air, converted to a flame, gives a known amount of energy of that flame. And that's sort of the information you're looking for, Joe. So it's a direct proportion of gallons per hour, as I see it, assuming the mixture is being set correctly. WA2RYY, K2RYW, the TechNet.
Yes, it's what I'm looking for. It's a linear function in a roundabout way. Even though the original rating is 1.25 GPH at probably 100 pounds, which most likely they rated it at, gives you 151,000 BTU. So if you cut that number in half, which is about 0.65 or somewhere around there, but you're actually raising that GPH to, I think, 0.81 GPH because of the higher pressure. It runs more gallons per hour, obviously. So the BTUs would be in a linear function. They wouldn't be half. They'd be a little more than half of the original rating. Is that what I'm gathering from what you're saying?
Yes, it is a direct proportion. Now, when you set a 0.65 gallons per hour nozzle with that rating at 100 pounds per square inch, when it fed 150 pounds per square inch, which is now the recommendation when you go to the Delavan, I think it was one of the major manufacturers of nozzles for the oil burner. I think it's the Delavan company, and they have a very nice manual that's downloadable free of charge that gives you lots of information. And so when you go from 100 to 150 pounds per square inch feeding the nozzle, you do get more fuel, but not 50% more, because the fuel is squirting through that orifice at close to the speed of sound for that orifice, if you know what I mean. One of the things I was going to ask as a puzzle, but now I'm giving the information out, is that the little hole in the front of the nozzle of a 0.65 gallons per hour is something in the vicinity of 5/1000ths of an inch in diameter, a very small hole. And the depth of that hole is probably 1/8 of an inch. So when 0.7 or 0.8 gallons per hour is squirting through that tiny little hole, that oil is really moving fast. got to make sure that it's very well filtered. Let me drop it. In my case, that oil flows through four cascaded filters. I've got a coarse filter. One of those very fine white cartridge filters is in series with the coarse filter. That in turn goes through a screening that's right in front of the pump. There's a screening in there, which is not doing much because the screening has got much bigger holes than the two filters. And then on the back of the nozzle itself, there is a bronze, sintered bronze filter. So there's four cascaded filters that the oil has been through before it gets to that nozzle. And you really don't want that nozzle to jam up. And so, and you're supposed to change it once every year. The nozzle's, what, $8 or $10. It's a small investment. But no matter how well you filter the fuel, there's always going to be a little bit of fine dust in there that's eroding that nozzle. There's a way you can take the nozzle apart and look at what's inside of it. It's a very precise piece of machinery. And the nozzles come in a blue package, which is a Bravo, which means a solid flame, or red package, which is a hollow flame. And they come with gallons per hour, the flare angle, you know, 80 degrees it may square up the world, the oil at over an 80 degree region with solid, so a 0.65 Bravo blue package. So I think one of the ones you can buy that I use is 80 degrees and 0.65. That's my favorite nozzle. Let me drop one other thing I was going to say. Whenever you are doing your own service, my strongest recommendation is you go to the smallest nozzle that you think you can tolerate. Many a burner comes with a much too big a nozzle where with the air opening mechanism opened all the way, it can't supply enough air, therefore you get a sooty flame, and you get a loud rumble in the flame. In my case, a 0.65 gallons per hour can keep my house warm on a minus 15 degree day. It's going to run close to 100% of the time, but that's not bad. And you get a much better fuel-air mixture. When you've got the right amount of air going into that mixture, it does not make black soot. After 2 years, I took my old burner apart, and I was going to clean out the soot from the flue pipes. There wasn't any. Amazing. So this black soot that you get inside your furnace, that's because of insufficient air in the burner, which is making a sooty flame. And that's a big waste. You're making a certain amount of carbon monoxide in the process. You're making soot that jams up the works. The soot coating onto your boiler or onto your heat exchanger, if it's a warm air system, is an insulating material that restricts the amount of heat being transferred from the flame to your house, so to speak. So getting the right fuel-air mixture. I'm trying to remember now the call letters of the guy who is a member of LIVOC, who worked for Brookhaven Laboratories. He got a contract from Brookhaven Laboratories. Oh, why can't I think of his call letter and name right now? He investigated a large number of the private oil burner systems in homes, and he found a lot of them are being misset. Over to you, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW, and the TechNet.
You said something interesting about the packages, and I've typically bought the red packages that are labeled 0.6580A. Now, you said the color of the package has to do with the shape of the cone. What does the A stand for? Because I've also seen them like B on the same colored package. I think red container. So is there something else I should know about that?
Yeah, when you read the manual from Delavan, I think it's the name of the company, I believe red package and A go together, meaning a hollow flame. And B and blue package, I think, means a solid flame. And there's some intermediate ones, but B and blue, I think, go together, solid. A and red, I think, means hollow. And depending on the design of your burner, what's the best way for the flame to be either hollow or solid? I think solid is more popular, but that's just my belief. And the letters and the colors, I think, is made more clear in that manual that you can download, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW.
Well, the oil guy was putting in a new boiler because the other one completely been like that for months and months and months. Anyway, he didn't know the setting or what type of nozzle I should use, so you suggested, I think it's Delavane, is maybe the name of the manufacturer that makes a very popular nozzle. I should go to their website, and they probably have the information directly for the type of boiler and burner I plan to use with the new installation.
Whether or not the Delavane manual specifically addresses your boiler, there I'm skeptical. However, the manual will give you a lot of information about the various kinds of nozzles they make, flare angles and particle size, atomization size, whatever. So lots of good information is there that'll answer some of your questions. Now, when it comes to what is the ideal nozzle for your particular burner, usually there is some kind of a metal plate on the burner itself that says, with this burner, don't exceed 0.9 gallons per hour. And the ideal burner, the ideal nozzle is X number of degrees of angle and either solid or hollow flame. So the ideal nozzle for your particular furnace, usually there is a sign somewhere on the furnace itself that recommends that, Joe. Over to you, Joe, KQRIW.
Well, there wasn't on the old boiler. There was not anything on the old boiler or the burner that I ever saw. I found that information out because the burner happened to be a Beckett burner on a Whale McLean boiler. I mean, the Whale McLean boiler changed, and I'm still going to use the old burner. So I don't know if that changed. I know what type of nozzle I've used in the past with the boiler I used to have, but with the new boiler, I don't know what they require for that particular size chamber it's going to be for physical size. So I have to maybe consult the manufacturer of the boiler and see what they recommend internally. But, okay, good information to know. That's pretty much about it. I had an idea that it might be in a linear function as far as you could decrease the size. The BTUs would go down accordingly in the same, almost linear fashion. So I guess you pretty much answered my question. Thanks, Dick. Over to the next guy, W2YY.
Yeah, oil, when it is properly atomized, properly oxygenated, and properly burned with a retention head burner or whatever, gives off a given number of BTUs. The burning of oil has a very fixed number of BTUs per volume of oil. And so I like to make sure that there is sufficient air so that you're not getting a smoky flame. And quite often your burner service person will measure the temperature of the stack material. He adjusts the oil, the oil-air mixture. He's adjusting the amount of air until he gets maximum temperature. That sounds logically like the right place to go. I don't agree with that. Here, not everyone's going to agree with me. Your nozzle is trying to break up the oil into a very fine mist of very fine particles. It's atomizing it. Well, those particles really have a Gaussian distribution. Some of the particles are a little bit larger, some of the particles are a little bit smaller. And so when you're adjusting the amount of air to get maximum temperature, you're giving the right fuel-air mixture for the middle of the Gaussian curve. But for the droplets that are a little bit larger over to the right on the Gaussian curve, they're not getting enough air, and they're giving you off some carbon monoxide and some soot. I'm willing to put a little bit more air in there where the flame runs a little bit cooler, but it doesn't make soot, and it doesn't make carbon monoxide. I'm willing to have a little bit less flame, a little bit less efficiency, in order to get a clean burn. And therefore, I don't have to go through all that cleaning process every year or so to get rid of all the soot that was created by insufficient burning. So I'm in favor of a little bit of excess air up to the point where you're starting to blow out the flame, so to speak. When you look at the flame itself, you can judge by whether or not there's any soot coming off the tops of the flame, depending on the amount of air you're giving it. And there are all kinds of instrumentation you can use. Let me drop measure the constituents of the flame of the flue gases, and I'm wondering if that's really the right way to go. So, I've been doing my own oil drum service since 1970, and I've been using the philosophy you've been hearing about. For me, it works. On a not very well insulated house, I burn something like 1,200 gallons per year, keeping the house at the 73 degrees Fahrenheit.
My new washer machine
runs on a brushless DC motor. Doesn't have a transmission. So the rate at which it turns, chugging back and forth or spinning when it's doing drying, the rate at which it turns is strictly a function of the way the electronics feeds that motor that's turning that drum. K2GJE, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2GJE. Okay, I know what's happening. That's what happens inside a standard three-phase motor. And these motors, there's only two leads coming to them with some DC source, which they're very similar to the cooling fans in your computer. So there's some electronics then buried in that stator. Okay, something you can't see. Okay, thank you for giving us a little dissertation. Back to net.
Yeah, there's a number of good articles on the internet that'll explain it better than I have. So brushless DC motors now are very popular. And in the old days, you had a complicated armature and brushes that were wearing out and lots of arcing and sparking going on. We've come a long way in the design of motors. And much of this is being made possible because of these extremely strong magnetic fields you can create with neodymium magnets. Neodymium, iron, cobalt, I'm not quite sure, but modern-day magnets are really potent. Okay, Rich was next. WB2, GXM, K2RIW. You got it, Rich.
K2RIW, WB2, GXM. First comment, then my question. The comment, nice to see you back in town, Sheriff. It's awfully quiet without you around here. Tumbleweeds going through middle of town. It's quiet. Almost too quiet.
Yeah, I was under the weather. A few weeks ago, I got a flu shot, and I think I was getting an after effect from the flu shot one of those weeks. And another week, I was under the weather for another reason. I hope I'm going to be around from now on, each one of these weeks, but we'll see. I'm getting older, getting a little more tired, and so putting on 4 hours worth of TechNet is becoming a little bit of a drain. I'm tempted to tell people that, hey, I'll be involved in the first hour and a half, and then Roy and Paul will take over for the rest, and because each of their sections people consider valuable, and I don't necessarily have to be there for that for those sections. In theory, I could go to bed a little bit earlier. Okay, we've heard your comment. And great, you appreciate that that the first TechNet of 2020 is taking place. And go ahead with your question, Rich, K2LIW.
Okay, well, we love you and we missed you. I have a question which is also pretty much non-radio, so I'll make it 3 for 3, even though it may use radio components. I think I could save some money on my utility bill by running my refrigerator on inverter power, maybe or maybe. I know that the refrigerator is an inductive load, and I was thinking if I could run it off of an inverter supplied by a battery charged by a solar panel, and maybe have a gate that would switch it to house power when the battery ran down too low. What do you think of that?
I may be overly conservative on this one, Rich. I do not recommend that. The beautiful 60-cycle sine wave that used to be silent light, but now is what beautiful sine wave they supply keeps the compressor motor quite happy. With rare exception, an inverter puts out something closer to a square wave or a stepped square wave. A stepped square wave going into that compressor motor is going to definitely change its efficiency. Very likely a lower efficiency because as that motor rotates, it is designed for a pure low harmonic content sine wave being fed into that motor in order to run it. Your inverter, to make an inverter produce a low harmonic content, pure step square wave out of an inverter and filter it and convert it into a pure sine wave. You feed anything but a pure sine wave into that motor. I'm reasonably sure it'll run hotter and lower in efficiency. On top of that, let me drop the compressor itself, that motor. I don't think you can get anywhere near enough reliability out of an inverter. To design an inverter capable of putting out a pure sine wave is an extremely difficult thing to do, and it's only a matter of time before that electronics breaks down, and in various modes of failure of that electronics, it can start producing a waveform that can do an awful lot of damage to that compressor. Now, the motor that's the compressor of a refrigerator is not too different from the motor that's the compressor for a household air conditioning system. And here, they sell a kind of a interrupt detector. They sell a circuit for, I think it's only $15 or so, that if you have a small interruption of your power being fed to your house, so that the compressor, while it's running, stops, and then the power comes back on. The freon that was in the piston at that time turns into a liquid, and then when the power comes back on, the compressor is trying to compress the liquid, which it cannot do. And the motor sits there in a locked rotor mode, doing a very loud hum, and there is a thermal switch inside that when the motor overheats because of this locked rotor condition, the thermal switch opens. At first, that sounds like the good news. It's bad news, because a locked rotor, your motor may be drawing 30 amperes if it didn't blow the fuse, and when that set of contacts inside from overheating opens up, it is interrupting a 30 ampere circuit, and it's doing some pitting of those contacts, so that thermal overload switch that's inside of your compressor motor of a air conditioner, there's only a fixed number of times you can operate that thermal switch before you get a complete failure, where it either doesn't make contact or the contacts get welded together forever and things really burn up real fast. So if your air conditioner doesn't have this interrupt detector, what the interrupt detector does, let me drop. It detects the fact that the compressor was running and that loco gave you a fraction of a second interrupt. It then makes sure that the command to turn on your air conditioner, which is usually coming from the thermostat, it makes sure that that command is interrupted for the next 3 or 4 minutes so that the freon that was in the piston that turned into a liquid gets a chance to go back to the vapor form so that now the start cycle for the compressor stands a chance of really running again. So you can get tremendous life increase out of your compressor if you have that circuit sold by Sid Harvey, among other people. This interrupt detecting circuit, which makes sure that your compressor is not trying to run when an interruption took place, which creates a locked rotor. So that kind of a locked rotor condition can easily happen on a household air conditioner, and I believe it can also easily happen on a refrigerator. Over to you, Rich. WB2GXM, K2RI, WM, the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I hear you, and I guess I will lay off on this idea. It's a shame because I think the refrigerator accounts for most of the power consumption that Con Ed is charging me. But I want this refrigerator to last. It's also a very old refrigerator, so it's still doing very well, knock wood, and I'd hate to upset it. K2RIW, WB2JXM.
Is it at all clear, Rich, as why to make an inverter create a pure sine wave is extremely difficult? Yes, you could build a very high power Class A amplifier that generates that 120 volt 60 cycle sine wave. It would be running at 40% efficiency, the amplifier creating the sine wave. An inverter has switching transistors that either switch in two states or four states with a step square wave or a pure square wave. In either case, that square wave or step square wave is very rich in harmonic content. It's an extremely different waveform than the compressor motor was designed for. The compressor motor would give you the best efficiency with the way it was designed with that particular sine wave waveform that comes out of your power company. To create that in your home electronics is extremely difficult. To convert a square wave into a sine wave, you'd say, well, it's just a simple filter. Oh, boy. You're talking about lots of watts of filtering, and it takes a big chunk of iron with some very fancy AC capacitors in order to convert that sine wave, that square wave, or step square wave, into a sine wave. So reliability-wise, waveform-wise, efficiency of the motor-wise, survival of the whole circuit, there's a zillion reasons why I don't recommend you do that. So do some research as to what you would have done had you followed through. You'll eventually find out that it's extremely non-recommended, in my opinion. And so I don't claim to be a motor expert, but I can see as that rotator, as the armature of that motor turns, the waveform that it's looking for in the stator is a very pure sine wave, if you know what I mean. How are you for any final comments on this one, Rich? WB2GXM, T2RI,
It's all understood. Thank you, Dick. And Happy New Year. T2RI, WB2GXM.
Okay, the next person on the runway was Lee, Kilo Delta 2, Delta Romeo Sierra. Go right ahead, Lee, K2 Romeo. My name is Dick. KD2DRS, are you there, Lee? Do we keep you waiting too long? K2RIW. Out of curiosity, is there anyone else that wants to do a late check-in to the TechNet? Because you do have a question or a comment. Give me your call letters right now and name, please. K2RIW. House. Occasionally somebody will leave a dome light on or leave the trunk lid ajar so that the light inside stays on. On a couple of occasions, that battery has run down. And I own one of these Sears Roebuck battery chargers. I think it's only rated for 15 amperes, 10 or 15 amperes. And so it's got two great big alligator clips on it. You connect the red one to the positive lead and the black one to the negative lead of the battery and plug in the 110 volts to that charger. And that brings our car battery up in an hour or two or three. That brings it up to a reasonable charge where the car will now start running on its alternator and the battery is off and running. When you take a lead-acid battery, when you take a lead-acid battery and drain it down to the point where it can no longer run the starter motor, you don't want to dwell there very long, and because it is destructive. It is doing damage to the plating on the plates, if you know what I mean. And so you want to recharge it as fast as you can, not leaving it very long in the discharge state. But in my case, running an extension cord out to the charger. The charger itself, I open up the hood of the car, place the charger right above the radiator, connect the clamps, and then run an extension cord out there. Running it on 110 volts from the house is the convenient way to do it. Now, it may take a whole lot of extension cords, and running those extension cords out into the street, I can see how that could be unpleasant for you. Maybe there's a way you can drive the car up closer to the house where an extension cord is more convenient. But running the charger to charge the battery from an extension cord from household to 120 volts, 60 cycles, is my recommended way of doing it. To discharge another battery through an alternator, through a charger, my goodness, that's a fairly elaborate procedure. And then you got to recharge the battery that supplied the energy. So what is the reason you can't get a long enough extension cord to bring the 110 volts to the charger where the charger is mounted right in under the hood of the automobile itself? Over to you on that one, Howie. K2EIR, K2IW, and the TechNet.
Roger. Just remember Ohm's Law, EIR. This is K2EIR, Ohm's Law. Well, Dick, the main reason is I live in a condominium, and usually the parking spaces are across the driveway from my building. So I can't really run that across, especially in wet weather, snowy weather and all that, because they'll come with the plow and try to remove what remaining snow and ice are on the driveway, and they will take the cord, power cord, with them. So, you know, there are things like that. Basically, one doesn't want to upset the powers that be, mainly the board of directors here, with something like that. So that's the main reason. Over.
Yeah, that's becoming more clear now that I see the physical layout of your condominium. There's another suggestion I would think you should look into. I've seen a number of these ads for what I call a jumper battery. It's a battery that's, half a cubic foot in volume, and the advertisements show you that it's got two great big clip leads coming out of it. And it's also got other sockets in there where you can plug in a cigarette lighter and charge your cigarette lighter plug and charge cell phones and whatever. But they make this jumper battery-like thing. I think it's around $100. And the way it's advertised is that it will jump-start 15 or 20 automobiles that have a completely dead battery. You connect it to the car battery, this jumper battery. It puts enough juice into the car battery that you can run the starter motor. Once the starter motor starts up your engine, the alternator of the engine will put out 100 amperes when it's running at the right rate. So when it comes to recharging the battery in a hurry, the alternator in your automobile, if you're willing to run that automobile motor out there, can charge it at a very fast rate. In fact, all you really need to do is to charge the battery, let me pick a number, 20%, so that the next time you want to use it 4 days later, there's still enough charge left that you can start it and drive everywhere you're driving. And while you're driving, that battery is being recharged. So one of those jumper setups think is a very nice way of going. And some people keep one of those in the trunk of the car for an emergency service so that they can start other people and start theirs if something goes wrong. So these, I don't know what they're called. I'm calling it a jumper battery.
CUS-1.
Go ahead, Paul. I bet you've seen some of those ads and you know what it's cost and what it's called. WS2N, go ahead, Paul. T2IW.
My favorite one is the Die Hard. And, you know, there's so many companies that make these things. But, you know, some of them, they come with air compressors and all of this. All I want is the chopper. And the Die Hard by Sears so far is very good. And, you know, it does have an emergency light, and it does have USB capability, plug, you know, recharge your phone if you want. But it's light, and I know he said he doesn't want to lift anything heavy. I mean, this is one hand, not heavy at all, like maybe the weight of a six pack of soda, you know, it's really very good. And, you know, like you said, you just you turn the switch in the back to put it on. In the on position, hook up your red and black, and it tends to start cars. I have all four cylinder, and it'll do six cylinder. Don't know if it'll do an eight. I guess it depends on the vehicle. I've done. I've heard people are carrying it in the back of my car. In fact, I was at Kmart not too long ago, and some young fellow was having trouble. I gave him a jump. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, what is the name of this product? I think you said it's a Sears Roebuck product. Brand name is Die Hard. Is it called a Die Hard jumper battery? And what's the approximate cost of it, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
I got mine on sale. I think it was probably $60. I think they usually around 70, something like that. And, what do I call it? A jumper battery. Jumper. This is my second Die Hard because I had two cars. So they had one older one, which was good. But then as time went on, they came out one with USB on it. I like that. So that's the more modern one that I have now. So if you have two cars, you know, throw one in each trunk. You gotta be religious about keeping them up. You know, you gotta be that type of guy. Most hams are. You know, take it out. Recharge it every 3 months. Make sure you got a good charge on it in case you need to jump your car. And I'm pretty good at that. Back to you, Dick.
That sounds like a handy thing to have. What's the longest period of time you've ever had one of those? Have you had one of them for, say, 3, 4, 5 years? And so I guess once every 3 months you carry that jumper battery into the house and plug in the wall horn in order to charge your jumper battery. Is that what you do, Paul? And boy, that sounds like a nice approach. And I think you're saying that Sears Roebuck still sells that product. Well, we're getting a lot of static here tonight. WS2N, K2IW.
I hear the static. Yeah, I'm sure they do. I got mine, I guess, about 3 years ago. And then one before that, many years before that. And I had one originally. When they first came out, it was in the 90s. And that's been on the hammer side. I think about 17 amp hours. I still have it, but I just use it as a backup around the house. If you have power failure, you can bring it up, put it on the table. It's got its own light. Plug your phone into it or something. So that one's probably in the 90s. That time frame, I probably bought that one. I still have it. I mean, it doesn't leak or anything. It's terrific. That's completely different. The new ones, these diehards, they don't come with an extension cord. You know, you have your own extension cord, plug it in, and then plug it into your 110 to give it a charge. It does have a cigarette plug on the side, too, so if you want to run appliances out of it, you can. Let me drop it. Putting air on my tires, I have one of these, you know, little compressors that run on 12 volts. Again, I don't like the ones that are combined, you know, I don't know. And maybe they're good, but I'd rather have it separate. So if I have to put air in my tires, I'll take the jumper out, put it next to the tire, take the little air compressor out, plug that, you know, 12 volts into the air compressor. I'm not crazy about plugging. See, I'm not crazy about plugging into my car with the 12 volt connection as the car is running. So I use the battery jumper only because I've had failures before. You know, fusible plugs going and fuses going and all of that. You know, so I keep away from the cigarette outlet. Back to you, Jeff.
Sounds like a nice way to go. When's the last time you've seen an advertisement, and do you think Sears is still selling that product? And I'm guessing if we go to their websites, we'll find a number of companies that will sell that product. I'll bet you've seen that in other brands besides Sears Roebuck. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, I bought one. Same company that you put antifreeze in your car. You got a mental block, you know. They were making them. I wasn't happy with that one. I bought it back. Didn't like it. Didn't have enough amperage as far as I was concerned. So I'm a diehard fan. You know, I go back, you know, a long time. You know, if Sears ever closes, that'll be it for me. I'll be stuck with Harbor Freight. Harbor Freight has them, too. I don't know if they're any good there. Back to you.
KC1SAM.
KC1SAM. Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, if you go to Google and put in a diehard jumper box, it'll come up, and they probably have six or eight different sizes from diehard. There's other ones there, too. They go anywhere from $70 up to $170. Depending on the amperage on what you want. But they look like they're very, very available. I don't have one, but they're there if you want to look them up.
K2EIR.
Go right ahead, Howie.
Thank you, Dick. Life is signaling me that I should get out and join the family. Yeah, Harbor Freight has been very lucky here outside of White Plains. They just opened the store in the last year here, and so I can get a number of things. I have about six jump start batteries. That's what they call jump start batteries. They typically have a 20 amp hour battery inside, and they typically rate these things for 400 amp starting current. That's very typical of this stuff over the last several years. And the batteries and the chargers, you know, the jump start box, have pretty much been the same. Price has gone up. Well, what do we expect? What I'm trying to do these days is move away from those lead-acid batteries and go to lithium-potassium batteries. I go to Harbor Freight and I buy a plastic ammo box, and I put the battery, the lithium-potassium battery, in there, and use Anderson power poles both ways. Supposed to charge it and to draw current off of that. And that's the way I can operate portable and for emergency power. But I haven't done anything yet with that, with the cars. You have to be careful with these types of batteries because they have battery management systems built in, and you can't draw too much current from them, so that if you use a lithium-potassium battery in your car, although some brands are made for that, but the problem is that typically you will either draw too much current from it or you'll get too much charging current back from it, back from the car with the alternator. So you have to do some preventive work if you're going to start changing chemistry. But that's my experience. I thought I'd add that in. I'm going to go watch TV with the family. I thank you all for your opinions, and it's great to hear you on. The TechNet has always been a valuable service. And, Dick, I remember first getting acquainted with you through a QST article. It must have been 20 years ago, showing your satellite dish in the backyard. So it's always nice to know we're still alive and kicking. I wish you all the best. K2RIW from K2EIR. 73, gentlemen.
Yeah, Howie, you and I both have short memories. That article about the 12-foot parabolic dish for listening to the Apollo astronauts on Apollo 15 and 16, that was the August issue, 1972, QST. That makes it, it's going on, let's see now, 49 years ago, something like that. That's more than 20 years ago, that article. And that was an article, I had a number of articles that year, also the parallel kilowatt amplifier for 432. Paul, the jumper diehards that you're talking about that you've owned, is that a lead acid battery or is that some other kind of chemistry? And is it a sealed lead acid? Maybe it's a gel cell. Do you have to worry about spilling the acid out of it? WS2N, K2RIW.
I've read that it's lead acid, but I mean, it's, they don't leak. I have it all when I'm telling you it's got to be late 1990s. And I don't even think about it. As far as I know, they don't leak. So, I don't know if it's a gel cell. I really don't know, Dick. I'll look into it.
It sounds to me like it's a let me drop it. It sounds to me like it's a completely sealed cell of some kind. Sounds like it doesn't have filler caps where you put water in it, so to speak. Sounds like it's a gel cell, or there's a kind of lead acid battery that's completely sealed. Sounds like it's a low maintenance item. Is there any danger involved where you use it for jumping your battery to get your car started, and when the car is running, the alternator is putting out 100 amperes, and the voltage is coming up real fast, and does that charge then go back into your jumping circuit? Is this something that protects that, or is there anything to worry about by your jumper battery being charged to the car battery while the alternator is putting out a higher voltage? Do you worry about that, or do you just disconnect it in a hurry and then go back to charging it with a wall wart in the house? WS2N, K2RIW.
Oh, by the way, it's not no wall wart. You just take a 120 extension cord, and it's got a male plug that you plug it into. I don't worry about when this starts, you're gonna get an inductive kick. Sometimes these things are diode protected. Now I'm going by what I have. Maybe there's other stuff, some off brand that might not have that. I guess they probably all do. They have it if you hook up the positive and the negative accidentally in reverse. It knows that. So, no, I don't worry about it at all. There's no maintenance, zero maintenance.
So you've owned that jumper battery system for multiple years. You've given it no maintenance, except something like once every 3 months you make sure you plug it in to make sure it's fully charged. Does it have any kind of an indicating needle on it to let you know that it's fully charged? Or do you measure the voltage? How do you know it's got a full charge? Paul, go ahead.
It has a series of LEDs, not LCDs, LEDs. And, if it's down low, like a yellow one will come on and it'll say, 50% or something. And then you'll have a solid green for 75%, and then when it starts blinking green, that means it's 100%. You can unplug it and bring it out, put it back in your car. Now, you don't have to worry about overcharging these things either. You could leave it in, like the guy I know that car service is, very close to here. He leaves them plugged in all the time, 24 hours a day. So if one of his mechanics has to go out and get somebody because the guy stalled somewhere, he's got his jumper, he jumps him and brings him into the station. Back to you, Dick.
Sounds awful handy. Thank you. Let me drop this. I think you said it's about the weight of a six-pack. Amazing. Some of the ads I've seen will lead you to believe you could have 10 or 15 vehicles in a parking lot all with a dead battery. And one after the other, this jumper thing will start every one of them before it runs down. Have you ever seen any ads like that, Paul?
give up, you know, we called it, but it was still cranking up, probably 1 minute, it was starting to drop down, you could hear it, you know, and then they called the service guy, and he just came and towed it away.
When you connect a jumper battery to your car battery, and your car battery was previously essentially dead, immediately you'll see a spark and current is flowing from the jumper battery into your car battery. And if you sit there and wait for a little while, a certain amount of charge will get into your car battery. And now when you start running the starter motor, you're drawing current out of two batteries at once. And you can get a nice fast run of the starter motor. So in the instructions that come with this jumper setup, do they recommend you connect it to the car battery and wait a couple of minutes before attempting to do the starting function? Over to you, Paul, KQRAW.
I don't remember reading that, but that's what I do out of habit, you know, days gone by. You know, and it's, when I, back in the 70s, I used to carry an extra battery with me, you know, a regular car battery, you know. I remember going to work one time, and the guy had a problem, you know, the guy I was working with had a problem with his car. I said, I'll give you a jump. He goes, oh, well, okay, pull your car up here. I said, no, I got my battery. Pulled a regular car battery out of my trunk and jumped him with it, you know. I said, you know, he said, wait, you got a battery in your car? I said, well, don't everybody have that? And actually, I got that from there was a service guy in the air conditioning world. He came from the Netherlands. And he said they drive around over there with two batteries in their car. I mean, under the hood. And they think nothing of switching back from one to the other. I thought that was strange, but that always stuck with me.
And two, APG. Dave recognized, get you in a second. Paul, you've got a battery sitting in the trunk of your car. How do you tie it down? If you make a panic stop, if you make a fast turn to the right or the left, that battery could be rolling around in your trunk. Do you have some way of tying that down, Paul? Go ahead.
I mean, I don't remember what I did. I probably took the spare tire and pushed up against it. You know, these were all, you know, $100 cars, Dick, back in the old days, you know, when I first started driving as a kid.
I understand. N2APG. Dave, do you walk around with a jumper battery in any of your vehicles? You've got it, Dave.
And to APG, when necessary, yes. But I wanted to jump in with a battery recommendation from my own personal experience. If anybody needs a car battery, go to Walmart. The Walmart battery brand is EverStart. I recently replaced my car battery. It lasted 10 years before it crapped out.
Okay, so Walmart sells a car battery that you really like. You buy it from there rather than Sears, as Paul does. Does Walmart also sell one of these jumper battery setups that Paul's been talking about? Do you think that's a product at Walmart? Over to you, Dave.
I'm sure they do. They're widely available. There are two basic types with those. The older style, which are kind of chunky and big, use the gel cells. The newer styles, very small, compact, looks like a little paperback book. Those are the lithium ion batteries.
How about that? Let me drop it. The lithium ion battery. And do they claim how many jump starts you can get out of that before it has to be recharged? And the lithium ion battery, you got to be careful with those. There's a certain voltage below which you're not supposed to go with those, otherwise you get damage. And when it comes to charging it, you've got to be careful. If you overcharge it, they can start outgassing and do some terrible things. So you got to be kind of careful with lithium-ion batteries of the size we're talking about. Over to you, Dave, K2RIW.
Well, I think that, generally speaking, it's like any other piece of equipment. Read the owner's manual. Follow the owner's manuals, the manufacturer's guidelines. You won't have any trouble. Don't do anything stupid. You know, don't short it out, things like that. But, you know, Dick, I've been playing around with batteries for a long time.
and I've never had an issue.
Most well-made pieces of electronics that have a lithium-ion battery have a protection circuit connected to that battery at all times. The protection circuit makes sure that you don't overcharge it, make sure that you don't undercharge it, make sure you don't draw too much current out of it. So that protection circuit protects the lithium-ion battery so it doesn't do terrible things. So well-made circuits have a protection circuit connected directly to the lithium-ion battery. So these jumper batteries that you can buy at various places like Sears and Walmart and Harbor Freight, hopefully they have that circuit built in. And you've never carried one of these things like Paul is talking about. Is that true, Dave? And if you did, how many years did you own it? How many dollars did it cost? What brand name? And 2APG, K2RIW.
Yeah, I have a bunch of them that I've collected over the years and I've played with. Generally speaking, if you have a decent battery in your car, you're not going to need a jump pack. And again, my 10-year experience is pretty interesting with that Walmart battery. Also, with the Walmart battery, they sell so many batteries there. When I went in Thanksgiving of last year to purchase the new battery, it was November 25th. The battery had a date code of December of 2019. So it was a brand new, fresh battery on the shelf that I could purchase.
You went in there in November, and the date code of manufacture was December? predated, is that what you're saying, Dave?
Yep, it was a brand new battery. They probably just put it on the shelf the day before or something like that. But because all these batteries, there are only three or four battery manufacturers in the United States, all these batteries with different brand names, they all come from the same factory, so to speak. They all have a date code. Either there's a sticker on it or there's an embossed and printed date code, on the battery. And you can look on the internet, you can figure out, what the date code means. The Walmart battery is a sticker, and it says right on it, December 2019. So it's quite obvious what the date code is. And like I said, can't complain. The batteries are very good over there. And of course, I have no pecuniary interest in this.
What kind of a vehicle did you have that, I think you're talking about a personal automobile with a car battery in it that you bought from Walmart 10 years ago, and that battery lasted for 10 years. Well, you're a conservative guy, you probably treated the battery with a tender loving care, but still, 10 years is a lot. What brand of car was that? And I think you said that was a Walmart battery. Each time I go to Sears Roebuck to buy a battery, the guy asked me what kind of a vehicle you've got. He says, you're supposed to put so-and-so model number, and I go over there to the so-and-so model number, and it's only 80% of the size that was in my car to begin with. What I do is I measure the dimensions of the battery that's in my car. I then go to the batteries they've got on the shelf, so to speak, and find one that is the exact same size. I want the full volume of the battery, even if it's a little bit expensive. Maybe it's made for a Land Rover or whatever. And so I walk that battery over and I say, I'm buying that battery. And he says, what kind of a car have you got? I said, I will not tell you. I'm buying this battery. That's what I do. So what kind of a vehicle was it that the battery lasted for 10 years? N2APG, K2RIW.
N2APG, just an old Mercury minivan, nothing special. And just one thing I'm going to leave you with also, if you remember George Gluck, WA2WKV, he was in the business. He was in the automotive business. And one thing that he would always tell people when it came to batteries, he would talk about the Sears Diehard battery. And his quote was something to the effect that the Sears Diehard battery was the worst battery available with the best marketing out there.
Yeah, give me some words on that. What did he mean by that? If he worked for the company and he was saying that that product is not recommended, what was he saying was the disadvantage? Go ahead.
Well, he didn't... TV ad presence, you know, that you would see every winter. You'd see the ads of, you know, the diehard battery starting the car that's encased in ice, you know, this kind of thing. So they had a wonderful ad campaign. But he said that, you know, the battery was nothing special. It's just, you know, no big deal.
Hi, local. Let me drop this. I can't remember the name of the store near my house that sells automobile parts. But I bought a battery from them once, sitting on the shelf, put it in my car, and I forget something about the way it behaved. I could tell that the battery was not charged. I had to go through a charging procedure. Once I had gone through the procedure of installing it in the car, I wasn't going to bring it back to them. But I had the impression that the battery I bought had like a 5% charge, and I had to give it a... I had to pour current into it for a whole lot of hours before it was fully charged. That kind of amazed me. I guess some of these batteries are so-called dry charge. In other words, the battery has no fluid in it when it's being shipped. They pour in the acid, and then the battery is supposed to act fully charged after that. Do you know anything about that procedure, Paul? I mean, here we go. Dave, N2APG, K2RIW.
No, I know motorcycle batteries for the most part are sold dry. You purchase a motorcycle battery, you know, it's relatively small. It comes with a package of sulfuric acid that you add to the battery, and you charge it up a little bit, you're good to go. But as far as the car batteries, you know, Walmart, whatever, they're good to go, they're ready to go. And they're sealed, quote-unquote sealed. They have vent cells that are underneath the label. And this is interesting too. My battery was 10 years old, so at nine and a half years, I opened up the vent cell to take a look inside, and all the plates were still covered by electrolyte, but it was a tad low, so I added some distilled water. But so after nine and a half years, all the cells inside the quote-unquote sealed battery were still covered with electrolyte.
Did you have to stick a knife into a sharp edge at one corner? How did you open that so-called sealed battery? Give me some words on that. And when you added the extra fluid, the battery wasn't yet at end of life. It still had some juice left. Over to you, Dave.
Yeah, that's correct. The battery was still functioning fairly well. Underneath the label on top, you feel very carefully with your fingers, and you'll see there's a couple of the six round circles. Those are the vent caps. So you have to maybe take a razor knife, or very carefully you peel off the label, and underneath the label there you have six round vents that you very carefully pry up with a screwdriver, and now you can add water.
Okay, so... And after nine and a half years, you added some water. That's amazing. What made you finally give up on that battery? It wasn't holding charge?
One morning when I came out, the car would not crank. I went into the house, I took one of the jump packs, and I jumped the car. I was able to get it started, and then I knew it was time for a battery. So I drove over to the Walmart, parked my car, went inside, bought the battery, came out, installed the new battery in the car, returned the old battery for the $5 cord charge, and went on my merry way.
There's a slim chance that something in your car discharged the battery, that if you had recharged that battery before replacing it, it might still have had some life left. Right now, you don't know for sure. Over to you, Dave.
No way, no how. I was lucky to get 10 years out of it. Most people that I tell the story, they go, hey, are you kidding me? You get 5 or 6 years out of a battery, you're doing good. No, that battery was shorted out internally. That was it. There was no recharge in that battery.
In other words, when you measured the voltage, you had reason to believe that at least one of the cells was dead.
Yeah, you can tell. When you get in your car and you turn your key, listen to how fast it cranks, all right? Do that all the time. Listen to how fast it cranks. once you start hearing it crank slowly or slower than normal, you know there's an issue.
Yep. At least one of the cells is weak or discharged. Maybe the whole battery. Occasionally you'll get that condition because somebody left a light on and it can be recharged and restored. That's happened a couple of times in my family. Okay. One last call. Anyone else that's got a question or a comment for the question and answer section of the TechNet? Give me a call, let us a name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WSON. One more comment on the batteries.
You got it, Paul.
I heard what they said. You know, there's only a couple of companies that make these batteries. East Penn is the one that my mechanic called me. No matter what you're buying, it's coming out of East Penn. That's the name of the company. You know, because I was asking him, you always put interstate batteries in my car. What happened? Because he didn't like the deals he was getting from the company. Nothing to do with the battery he was putting in. I think I forget what I got after that. I guess it was Everstart. But I think that might be the Walmart name. Whatever he put in after that, he said it's the same battery. It comes out of East Penn. So... it really doesn't matter. Like Dave said, back to you.
My memory has just come back to a little bit more order. The man who was a prominent member of LIVOC 20 years ago, who had a contract from Brookhaven National Laboratory to investigate home oil-fired heating systems in private homes on Long Island, was Erwin Dresner. Don't remember his call letters. Somebody's going to tell me his call letters, but Erwin Dresner was the guy who, I think he told me he looked at 100 separate private houses and found out the vast majority of them, the oil burner was definitely misset, insufficient air making a sooty, smoky flame.